I was about to express my astonishment, when a patient near us called out, "Narcisa, Narcisa." I had no right to keep that devoted sister from her duties just to satisfy my curiosity. Chapter 29, Francis' Vision. While Narcisa was busy comforting the afflicted patient, I was called to a city communications device, similar to a telephone. It was Laura, asking for news. I realized that I had forgotten to tell her about my decision to remain in the chambers for night duty. I apologized and informed her of the situation. Even over the wire I could sense her joy at the news. At the end of our short conversation she said, "That's wonderful, my child. Love your work and fill your heart with the joy of useful. Only in this way can we bring about our everlasting edification. Now, just one more word. Remember, too, that this house is also yours." These words encouraged me and brought me joy. Returning to the chambers, I found Narcisa struggling heroically to calm a young man who seemed to be suffering from a serious mental disorder. I tried to help her. The poor boy, staring out into space, cried out in agony, "Help me, for God's sake. I'm frightened, frightened." With a panic-stricken look on his face, he went on, "Sister Narcisa, he is coming. The monster. I can feel the worms again. Here he is, right there. Save me from him. Send him away." "Calm down, Francis," answered the devoted nurse. "You will be free of him and will be left in peace, but it depends on your own efforts. Just pretend that your mind is a sponge, soaked in vinegar. You must wring out the sour substance. I will help you to do this, but the hardest part you must do yourself." At Narcisa's tender, encouraging words, the patient became calm and showed himself willing to cooperate. But in a few minutes he turned ghastly pale again, and began to cry out, "But sister, listen to me. He won't go away. He is back again to torment me. Look. Look." "Yes, Francis, I can see him," she agreed patiently, "but it is essential for you to help me drive him away." "Oh, what a diabolical ghost," he exclaimed, weeping like a child and inspiring my compassion. "Put your trust in Jesus and forget the monster," she advised in a soothing voice, "and now, let me apply a magnetic pass, and the ghost will go away." She gave him a magnetic treatment, filling him with invigorating, comforting fluids. He thanked her, looking greatly relieved. After the treatment was over, he spoke again. "Now I feel much better." After kneading his pillows and making him comfortable, Narcisa asked an attendant to bring him a glass of magnetized water. Her example was edifying, her goodwill was contagious. Perceiving my earnest wish to learn, she seemed willing to initiate me in the sublime secrets of service. "To whom was he referring?" I asked, greatly impressed. "Is he, perhaps, pursued by some shadow, invisible to my eyes?" "Oh, no," she replied, "he meant his own corpse." "You don't say so," I replied, take aback. The poor boy entered the spirit sphere after an accident due only to his own carelessness. He was excessively attached to his physical body, and for days he wouldn't leave his grave, refusing to conform to his new state. So deep were his delusions that he spent a long time desperately trying to raise his stiff body. He was terrified at the idea of facing the unknown, and utterly unable to muster even the slightest detachment from his physical sensations. Aid from higher spheres was of no avail. He had closed his mental zone against all thoughts of eternal life. At last, the worms made him experience such atrocious pain that the unfortunate creature ran away from his tomb horrified, only to begin a dismal wandering in the darker regions of the lower zone. However, those who had been his parents on earth enjoy considerable credit over here, and through their intercession he was rescued by the Samaritans who brought him, almost by force, to our colony. His condition is so serious that he won't be able to leave the chambers of rectification for a long while. The friend who had been his physical father is now engaged in a difficult mission far from the astral city. Does he come to see the patient? Yes, he has already come twice, and each time I was deeply moved by his silent grief. The boy's mental disorder is so great that he didn't even recognize his generous and devoted father. He kept crying pitifully, under painful delusions. His father, who had come to visit him accompanied by Minister Padule of Communication, showed emotional fortitude while in the presence of the minister to whom he owed his unfortunate son's hospitalization. They spent some time commenting on the spiritual condition of the newcomer. But when Minister Padua was called away unexpectedly, apologizing to me for his human gesture, he knelt by his son's bed, taking the boy's hands into his own, holding them tightly as if to transmit some invigorating vital fluids, kissed the boy's forehead, and wept. I couldn't keep back my tears, so I felt the room. I don't know what happened, but I noticed that from that day, Francis has been steadily improving. His condition of total insanity has been reduced to occasional crises, which are gradually diminishing. How touching this is! I exclaimed, deeply impressed, but how can his corpse pursue him? Francis' visions, she explained, are nothing but hallucinations. Many spirits suffer from them after physical death. Those who are excessively attached to their material body, who make it the center of their existence, living only through it and for it, cannot abandon their corpses when called to the real life. They do not accept the idea of spirituality, and struggle desperately to retain their physical bodies. In time, however, voracious worms drive them away. Then, horrified, they fall to the opposite extreme. The sight of their own corpse, a strong creation of their own minds, torments them to the innermost recesses of their souls. They live in crisis for more or less lengthy periods of time, and many suffer acutely until the ghost corpse they have created totally disintegrates. Noting how deeply affected I was, Narcisa continued. Thanks to our Heavenly Father, I have learned a great deal in these years of service. How profound the spiritual slumber of most of our incarnate brothers is. Still, we mustn't worry to the point of letting it hurt us. The chrysalis adheres to inert matter, but the butterfly will rise from it in easy flight. The seed is almost imperceptible, although it is to become the giant oak. The withered flower returns to the earth, but its perfume abides in the air. All embryonic life appears to sleep. We must never forget these lessons. Narcisa fell into a silence which I dared not interrupt. Chapter 30, Inheritance and Euthanasia. I had not yet recovered from my astonishment when Celestius came up to Narcisa and said, "Our sister Pauline wishes to see her father in Pavilion 5. Before complying, I thought I had better consult with you, as the patient is still experiencing a deep crisis." In her usual gentle manner, she replied, "Show her in at once. Pauline is devoting all her leisure time to the delicate task of reconciling the different members of her family, so she has Veneranda's permission to see her father whenever necessary." The messenger left hastily, and Narcisa informed me, "You'll see what a devoted daughter she is." Less than 1 minute later, we saw Pauline coming towards us. She was slim and lovely, reflecting angelical beauty, dressed in a light tunic of luminous silk. Her eyes reflected deep concern. The nurse introduced us politely. Probably feeling I could be trusted, she inquired anxiously, "How is father, my friend?" "A little better," Narcisa answered, "but still considerably unbalanced." "It's a pity," Pauline continued. "Neither he nor the others will give up the mental attitude in which they obstinately persist. Always the same hate, the same lack of understanding." Narcisa invited us to follow her, and in a few moments we were standing by the bedside of what looked like a disagreeable old man. With his bitter, scowling look, disheveled hair, deep wrinkles and retracted lips, he inspired more pity than sympathy. However, I endeavored to control my inferior vibrations and to see in this unfortunate sufferer only a spirit brother. My feelings of repulsion disappeared and my mind felt clearer. I applied the lesson to myself. How had I arrived at the Ministry of Assistance? How repelling my own appearance must have been, with utter desperation written all over my face. When we consider other people's misfortune in the light of our own imperfections, there is always room for brotherly love in our heart. The old patient had no words of affection for his daughter, who greeted him tenderly. He looked like a caged beast as he frowned at her, eyes glowering with harshness and rebellion. "Are you feeling better, father?" asked Pauline with loving respect. "Oh. No." The patient bellowed, "I can't forget the villain. I have no peace of mind. I can still see him by my bedside administering deadly poison." "Please, father, do try to forget all that," Shay earnestly entreated. "Remember that Idelbert entered our home as a son, sent by God." "My son? Never!" shouted the unfortunate old man. "He is a loathsome criminal, unworthy of pardon. He is the devil's own son, that's what he is." Pauline, eyes brimming with tears, spoke persuasively. "Father, let us learn from Jesus to love one another. On earth our family experiences are the means of teaching us real spiritual love. We must bear in mind that there is only one Father who is truly eternal, God. But the Lord of life grants us the blessed opportunity of fatherhood and motherhood on earth so that we may learn perfect brotherly love. They are the temples of sublime union, a preparation for universal solidarity. We have to struggle and suffer a great deal before acquiring the title of brother in the real sense of the word. The whole creation is but one family under the loving care of only one Father." Hearing his daughter's sweet voice, the patient broke into convulsive weeping. "Father, forgive Idelbert. Try to see in him not only the reckless son but the brother badly in need of enlightenment. I have just come from our earthly home, where I observed serious disturbances. From your sick bed here you are constantly projecting poisonous fluids of bitterness and incomprehension to them. They, in turn, are doing the same to you. Thought, as subtle waves, never misses its target, however distant it may be. The exchange of hate and suspicion causes ruin and suffering to the soul. Broken down by continual sorrow, mother was unable to resist the atmosphere at home, and was taken to a mental hospital a few days ago. Amelia and Casilda have brought a lawsuit against Idelbert and Agena because of serious disagreements about the large fortune you amassed on the physical plane. A sad situation indeed, but one which might gradually improve, were it not for your vigorous mind steeped in plans of revenge. Here, in the spirit sphere, I find you distressed. On earth, mother is insane and your children greatly disturbed, hating one another bitterly. Amidst all those unbalanced minds, a fortune in banknotes. What is the use of all that money, if it doesn't buy one moment's happiness?" "But I left my family ample means," retorted the unhappy old man. "I was anxious for their welfare." Pauline continued, interrupting him. "In the question of transitory riches, we don't always know what is the best thing to do. If you had assured your family's future by maintaining an atmosphere of moral tranquility in your home, and prepared your children to earn an honest living, your efforts might have been a great help. Sometimes, father, we accumulate money through pride and ambition. We are anxious to live above others, and while centering our attention on the external aspects of life we forget the more important, lasting side. Few are those who seek to acquire worthwhile knowledge, and the precious qualities of tolerance, humility and understanding. Instead, we insist on bending others to our will, neglecting the tasks assigned to us by our Father and altogether forgetting to cultivate our spirits. No one is born on the planet merely to hoard money in safes and banks. Of course, during our sojourn we may, as faithful stewards who know how to manage wisely what is entrusted to them, claim our legitimate share. But it is impossible to be our Father's faithful stewards if we are greedy and overbearing. It was that false understanding of divine stewardship that ruined a home. I tried in vain to render spiritual help to the family, while you and mother sacrificed yourselves to increase your worldly goods. Amelia and Casilda, disdaining any useful work, trifled away precious time, finally marrying idlers like themselves, who only married them for their money. Aegina, influenced by his worthless companions, wasted all opportunities of serious study. Idelbert graduated as physician, but was indifferent to the profession. He approached its noble activities only rarely, and even then only out of sheer curiosity. Spoiled by easily obtained money, and with minds fixed on the coming inheritance, they all ruined their fine spiritual possibilities. The patient, terror-stricken, cried out, "Cursed Idelbert! Criminal and ungrateful son! He murdered me pitilessly when I still needed to review the terms of my will. Malicious felon! Please, father, don't say that! Have mercy on your son! Forgive and forget!" But he went on cursing and swearing. Pauline was about to resume when Narcissa gave her a warning glance and called Celestius to help the patient, by this time aroused to a dangerous condition of emotional excitement. Pauline became silent, trying hard to keep back her tears. She continued by the bedside, stroking her father's forehead with a gentle hand. Painfully impressed by the scene I had just witnessed, I followed Narcissa and Pauline out of the ward. The two friends talked for some time, and then Pauline took her leave with kind words of thanks. Her eyes showed sadness and worry. When we were again alone, Narcissa remarked, "As a rule, inheritance cases are extremely delicate. With few exceptions, they cause great trouble for both testators and legatees. This case, however, is far more serious because of the euthanasia. Ambition for wealth created all kinds of complexes and misunderstandings in Pauline's family. Avaricious parents generally have extravagant children. I had accompanied her to her earthly home when her brother Idelbert, a gentlemanly doctor, used so-called easy death on his dying father. We did our best to prevent him from carrying out this plan, but it was all in vain. For financial reasons, the distressed son was anxious to accelerate his father's passing, and now you see the result: hatred and infirmity. God created beings and celestial regions, but we insist on transforming ourselves into diabolical spirits, creating our own individual hell." Chapter 31, The Vampire. It was 9 o'clock in the evening, and we had not yet had a moment's rest except for the short consultations necessary for the solution of spiritual problems. Here I saw a patient begging for help, over there another in need of magnetic passes. On our way to assist two patients in Pavilion 11, I heard screams in a nearby ward. I would have run in that direction, if Narcissa had not held me back. "Please don't go," she warned, "the sexually unbalanced patients are lodged there. The picture would be too painful to your eyes. Wait until you are better prepared." I did not insist, but thousands of questions rushed to my mind. A new world was unfolding itself and my curiosity was great. I had to concentrate on Lizia's mother's advice so as not to become distracted from my legitimate duties. Soon after 9, a quaint little man, to all appearances a humble worker, emerged from amidst the trees of the enormous park. I later learned that he belonged to the Sentinel Corps of the Chambers of Rectification. Narcissa greeted him and asked, "What is the matter, Justin? What is your message?" "I've come to inform you that an unfortunate woman is begging for help at the large gate that leads to the tilling fields. I believe she must have escaped the attention of the frontline sentinels," he answered, anxiously.
"And why don't you help her?" asked the nurse. The guard gestured and hastened to explain. "According to our regulations, we are forbidden to. The poor creature is surrounded by black spots."
"Really?" she exclaimed, taken aback.
"Yes, nurse. It's just as I tell you." "Then it's a very serious cause."
I was filled with curiosity, and followed her for a considerable distance across the moonlit fields.
We were surrounded by the silent park, its shady trees rustling gently in the soft breeze. After walking for well over a mile, we came to the gate. There stood the pitiful figure of a woman begging for mercy from the other side. I saw nothing but a squalid creature dressed in rags with a hideous face, and legs covered with raw sores, but, judging from her startled expression, I realized that Narcissa saw many more details, still imperceptible to me. Children of God, she cried on seeing us, please give shelter to my weary soul. Where is the paradise of the elect, that I may enjoy the peace I long for? I was filled with compassion at her tearful voice. Narcissa, though also sorry for the unfortunate beggar, whispered to me. Can't you see the black spots? No, I can't. Your spirit vision isn't sufficiently trained. If it depended on me, I would let her in at once, but on dealing with creatures in this condition, I can't decide for myself. I must apply to the chief warden on duty. She approached the poor woman, and said kindly, please, just wait a few minutes. We hurried back to the house, where for the first time I came into contact with the chief of sentinels of the Chambers of Rectification. Narcissa introduced us and then rapidly reported the occurrence. You were right to have come to me. He replied, let's go see her. We were soon back at the gate. The chief warden carefully examined the newcomer from the lower zone and declared, for the time being, this woman can't receive our assistance. She is one of the strongest vampires. By vampire, the spirit author refers to one who extinguishes life for personal advantage. Translator's note. I have ever come across. She must be left to herself. I could not help but shocked at those words. Wouldn't it be neglecting our Christian duty to abandon this unhappy sister to her fate? Narcissa seemed to think likewise, and tried to plead with the chief warden. But, Brother Paul, wouldn't it be possible to shelter this poor creature in the chambers? Pointing to the beggar who was impatient at the delay and complaining loudly, he addressed the nurse. To allow her to enter would be to neglect my responsibility as a warden. Narcissa, have you noticed anything else besides the black spots? Narcissa had not, and he continued. Well, I have. Count the black spots. Narcissa looked intently at the woman, and, after a few moments, replied that there were 58. Brother Paul continued, patiently. Those 58 dark spots represent so many children killed at birth. On each of these spots I can perceive the mental image of one of the little children whose life she extinguished, some by crushing blows, others by suffocation. This unhappy creature was a gynecologist who exploited inexperienced young women, committing heinous crimes under the pretext of easing the conscience of others. She is in a worse position than cases of suicide or murders who may, at times, show mitigating circumstances. I recalled the numerous cases in my practice when, to save the mother's life, the unborn child had to be sacrificed. But, reading my thoughts, Brother Paul added, of course, I'm not referring to legitimate measures which are forms of redeeming trials, but to the crime of killing those who have obtained the sublime right to live and are about to begin their sojourn on the physical plane. Yielding to the feelings of compassion inherent in noble souls, Narcissa again attempted to intercede on her behalf. Brother Paul, I was also a great sinner in the past. Please, let's take in this unhappy woman. I promised to make her my special concern. My friend, he answered, I know we are all greatly indebted spirits. However, we have improved enough to acknowledge our own weaknesses and work to redeem our errors. All this woman wants, for the time being, is to create disturbance and confusion among our workers of goodwill. Those who haven't yet freed themselves from the bonds of hypocrisy emit destructive forces. Now, what would be the use of our vigilance if it were not to keep out dangerous influences? Let's prove what I have said, he added, with a meaningful smile. He then approached the beggar and asked her, sister, what do you ask of our brotherly cooperation? Help, help, she replied, dolefully. "But, my friend," he reasoned, "we must learn to accept expiatory suffering. Why did you so often cut the life thread of helpless little infants, who, with God's permission, were about to begin their redeeming struggle on earth?" At these words she looked around apprehensively, assumed a hateful expression and shouted, "Who is accusing me of this infamy? My conscience is at peace. I spent my whole life on earth working on behalf of motherhood. I was charitable and pious, good and pure. I am sorry, but the record of your thoughts and actions tell a different story. I believe, sister, that you haven't yet received the benefit of remorse. When you open your soul to the blessings of God, acknowledging your own needs, then you may come to us." "Devil, wizard," she yelled furiously at him, "Satan's own follower. I'll never come here again. I am waiting for the promised heaven, which I hope to find." "Then please go your own way. Your heaven isn't here. This is a place of work, where patients are aware of their infirmity and are assisted by brothers and sisters of goodwill to struggle back to health." "I haven't asked for any remedy of assistance," she retorted angrily. "All I want is the paradise my good works entitle me to enter." Shooting us a parting look of hatred, she discarded the assumed appearance of a wandering beggar and walked away defiantly, with firm steps and a haughty gait. Brother Paul gazed at the retreating figure for quite a while, then turned to us and added, "Did you observe the vampire? She has crime written all over her and pleads innocence. She is obviously wicked and yet declares herself good and pure. She suffers desperately and feigns tranquility. She has created a hell for herself, yet pretends to be looking for heaven." We listened respectfully to the chief warden, who closed his valuable lesson by saying, "We must always be aware of appearances, either good or bad. Divine providence never forsakes anybody. Therefore, that unfortunate creature will find aid elsewhere. But for the sake of legitimate charity, in the position I hold here, I couldn't possibly open our doors to her." Chapter 32, Learning About Veneranda. Returning across the moonlit park, I experienced a strange sense of fascination. Those big, shady trees and flourishing patches of greenery held my admiring attention. As we walked, I questioned her about the surroundings. "This great park," she said, "not only contains the paths to the lower zone and the plants we cultivate for nutritious juices, but Minister Veneranda has also created delightful areas used for educational purposes." Noting my curiosity, she continued, "They are known as the Green Halls, and are situated in the midst of the trees. They are perfectly suited for the lectures given by the ministers of regeneration. The most beautiful is reserved for the governor's lectures when he visits us. Others are used for visiting ministers and students in general. Their elegant trees blossom periodically, looking like small, colorful towers of natural charm. The sky is our sheltering roof, allowing us to enjoy the blessings of the sun and of distant stars." "How marvelous these natural places must be!" I exclaimed. "They certainly are," she continued. 40 years ago, Minister Veneranda's idea aroused great enthusiasm all over the colony, and a campaign was begun to build a natural hall. Every ministry, including the Ministry of Divine Union, worked, with Veneranda's cooperation, to build delightful arbors all over the water park. I think the ones they built in the schools are the most interesting. They vary greatly in size and shape. One of them, which Veneranda built in the educational park of the Ministry of Elucidation, is star-shaped, contains prodigious vegetation, and is ample enough for 5 large classes taught by 5 different instructors. In its center is an enormous apparatus, similar to a projector, which can simultaneously show 5 different projections. Their initiative improved the city, providing areas which unite useful service, practicality, and spiritual beauty. "How are the halls furnished?" I inquired as she paused, "in the same style as earthly ones?" Narcissa smiled and continued, "No, it's different. thinking of gospel scenes of Jesus' passage on earth, Veneranda suggested that all building materials be taken directly from nature. Each hall has benches and chairs carved out of the ground and covered with soft, sweet-smelling grass, lending it a restful and distinctive beauty.